All right, happy Saturday, wherever you are. My name is Bromo. This is called There Is a Way Out. This is my 42nd episode already, and I'm really proud of each and every one of them. We last heard from someone who was battling the, well, he was sober for a while, and then he went out like a lot of people do. That's part of the, that's the nature of the business. First of all, my sobriety date is 2-17-09. I am not an expert by any means at all. I don't have any kind of certificates or anything. I just have 16 years of walking down that right path and learning from people that I have talked to and listened to. And I have a guest today all the way out. And what's the weather like out there, Kenny?
Oh, it's beautiful, man. You know, it's San Diego. You know
it's that. San Diego. Kind of a stupid question. Here, it's almost 70. And when that happens, usually there's a parade followed by people rollerblading and everything because people are so glad to be out in the streets from being through all the winter, you know. But San Diego, is that where you're from?
Yes, sir. Born and raised.
Born and raised. What kind of age guy are you, if you don't mind saying your age?
I'm 52.
52.
72. Yes, sir.
I got shoes older than you, Kenny.
Yeah.
All right. Well, for one thing, for those of you who are new to this podcast, There Is a Way Out, I do this for many reasons. One, it's selfish. Yes, it helps my sobriety out tremendously. So I got through about 15 or 16 episodes before I finally finished my story. And for many people who have heard it over and over and over again, they weathered through that. I'll say this every week. My strength are my guests, like Kenny. And Kenny comes to me. We've never met face-to-face, have we? Or did you meet me when I was on the radio show out there?
I met you in a banana thong at a Sky Show, I believe.
A banana thong at the Sky Show. For those of you that live in North Dakota, a banana thong is exactly that. It's a thong that's shaped like a banana, yellow. And the Sky Show, what he's talking about, is a one-of-a-kind thing that we had every year at the stadium in San Diego with the radio show and about 2,000, 3,000 people watching the live event and then going in and watching a football game. And usually, when I say usually, I mean 100%, I would lose a golf bet and have to go out and pay off a golf bet at the Sky Show, this live show that we would do. And a banana thong is exactly what you can imagine.
It's so much more than you can imagine, honestly.
Have you ever worn a banana thong, Kenny? Are you wearing one now?
Yeah, I declined to answer, sir, on the ground. I'm just...
No, that's fine. All right, a couple things. Kenny and I talked beforehand. I just want to mention that you are going to learn a lot about his story. You're also going to see and hear what this young man does in the community, and it's pretty impressive. Not to mention working in the field with people who are alcoholics and addicts. You do work with addicts too, is that right, Kenny?
Yes. I run a substance use disorder program, yes.
This is a vital person in a vital position that can save someone's life. And I know that because you and I have a mutual friend that I did a podcast with who turned my life around when I went to Pathfinders, and I'll never forget him. And these are the people that you always try to stay in touch with because, like I said, they were a lifesaver. They were sent down from the heavens, I believe. And it was my turn to finally get my act together and want to stay sober, and there were the key figures like the friend of ours that we have. Now, Kenny, what you take it from here. Do you want to tell part of your story? Do you want to tell what your weaknesses are as far as alcohol or drugs? it's up to you. You know how these things go. You've been to a meeting before.
Thousands. I want to get one thing out of the way. Kind of a fanboy, dude. This is cool. And I've been listening to your podcast since your last recording was Andy.
Okay.
And Andy's been one of my best friends for 36 years.
Now, when you started listening, I'm not an expert, so I'm hoping that you took that under your wing and knew that right away. But you knew that this arena that I have, There Is a Way Out podcast, that is strictly for people to share and help others who may be on the fence or who may be going through it, correct?
Correct.
Good. And what he just said, I mentioned a second ago, is Andy. Yeah, that was our last podcast with Andy. And since we talked about Andy and you talked about him, how is Andy doing?
He's made a little bit of contact. He's in treatment, which is wonderful. So knowing that he's in a place, actually, it wasn't long after, actually before he was scheduling podcasts with you.
Yeah.
He and I had talked. He talked about a place that he was planning to go. I know a lot of people in the field. I reached out to somebody and asked them. I hadn't had any associations with that treatment facility in years and years and years. I just wanted to know, is it still quality treatment? Would I send my best friend there? And it was vetted and said absolutely 100%. And he's been there a couple weeks.
And
his wife's visiting today. So
oh, that's beautiful.
Doing pretty well.
And yeah. And this is how Kenny and I got acquainted, besides the banana thong years ago in San Diego, because Kenny had reached out on my There Is a Way Out Facebook page. And for all of you out there, you are welcome to join. It is for everybody. He responded to a series of Facebook messages on There Is a Way Out about Andy. And I said, I got to meet this guy, because when I spoke to Andy off the air, Andy told me what a terrific person, what a monster of recovery, a supporter you are. And that's true. And this is why, you know, you're laughing because you sound humble, but I know you've heard this before many times, Andy, Kenny, I know you've heard this many times before. So, but continue. So Andy is going to be getting a visit from his wife, which is freaking huge when you're out behind the walls of a recovery home, and you've got certain regulations and rules. When family comes out to support you, it's big.
Yes. It's funny. I don't have the treatment experience. I never went to treatment myself. I have worked in treatment now going on 13 years. Dabbled in this early on, right after graduating high school. And then went completely different directions in the military, everything else.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And what high school did you go to?
Started at El Cap in Lakeside.
Okay.
Then Chaparral and El Cajon. I went to continuation schools mostly.
Right on.
And then
cool.
finished out in Ramona at Montecito High School.
Excellent. I believe last time we were on the phone, couple of weeks ago, I had mentioned that I would give anything to be out in Ramona, and you thought I was being sarcastic. Because Ramona is out in the sticks. For all of people who live out in North Dakota, they know what the sticks are. Ramona is outside of the San Diego city limits, kind of, but it's still a beautiful place. But Kenny, what, getting back to my question a while ago, and I ramble sometimes, what was your danger zone? What did you love so much? Was it booze? Was it everything?
Are we talking drug of choice?
Yes.
This last time was mostly alcohol.
Okay.
And I say this last time because I have a history of 18 relapses.
Wow.
I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous in a runaway shelter in El Cajon when I was 15 years old. And the journey from there took another 13 years of me going in and out and in and out and doing what we call the 1-2-3 shuffle. I'm going to kind of pretend to do the steps, and I'm going to do this and do that. And then it comes to that 4-step, and I really didn't want to do a personal inventory, and it's easier to relapse. So that destructive pattern followed me literally around the world. And eventually when I used a lot in my youth, I started dabbling in smoking cigarettes and stealing alcohol from my dad's bar when I was 9. By 13, I was addicted to meth.
Wow, that's a young age.
So, yeah, it's crazy because at this point, looking back, and I look at my son. My son just turned 19, and I look at him and how innocent and young still. And I go, what the hell? Where were my parents? What were they doing? So, anyway, to diverge off that. So
how long have you been sober now?
My sobriety date is August 21st, 2000.
Okay.
So 24 years, God willing, coming up on 25, which is, you know, I've been sober my entire 30s, my entire 40s, and I am making a go at it, baby.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So from relapsing several times, more than 10, you said 18, I believe, right?
18. And it's a big part of my story, and it's one that I have no qualms about sharing, because as soon as we start to turn our back on somebody, as soon as we go, you're not going to get it, you're never going to get it, they die.
You know? They die, they disappear, they go
killed.
Homeless.
And I've seen way too much death. And, you know, one of the things that I get to share with my clients is that there was always someone. Not every single person in my world turned their back on me, and there was always at least one.
Yeah.
And it's because of those one person that I'm alive.
Yeah.
I'm literally alive. I'm not serving first-degree murder charges in the federal penitentiary. I'm not dead, and I get to live a beautiful life where I'm really privileged and honored to give back. So.
Well, you said it perfectly before, you know, there has to be nothing more painful than seeing a promise in someone, seeing that want, and all of a sudden it turns sour, and then you said they wind up dead. It's that quick.
Mm-hmm. Very.
So can you tell us basically what your title is that you do? I know you have several hats that you wear.
I am the program manager of a drug and alcohol program for deaf adults.
Okay.
So it's outpatient substance use disorder, so both alcohol, drugs. We deal with all levels of addiction. We touch on, you know, sex addiction, gambling, things like that. But, you know, our primary focus, my degrees, my certifications are in substance use.
Okay.
I've been doing this now for 12, 13 years.
That must be fantastic. I mean, yeah, it's a job, and it must wear on you quite a bit. But I'm a radio guy, and a guy that's worn a banana thong in the past, maybe made people laugh here and there. But, man, I'll tell you, back of my mind, especially in the last 10 years, I have thought so much about how wonderful it would be. And I know that it sounds easy for me to say looking out the window, but how wonderful it would be to go to work and be able to be around people who you can change their life just by being there and by adding support and by adding wisdom and experience. I can't even imagine what that's like.
So do me a favor, brother.
Yeah.
I want you to, after the show, after you're done with work for the day, I want you to look in the mirror, okay? Because you are doing that.
Well, it's nice you to say, first of all, I don't like looking in mirrors. They don't like looking at me.
Me either. I have a face for radio, too.
Second of all, I will agree with you on one point. I used to take... my life was spiraling out of control when I was making people laugh, but I was doing what I loved. I was part of a morning show out there for 10 years, and I was basically being myself 99% of the time, and it was on the air, and I could really not lose. I mean, I really could not lose. If I bombed out with women, it made people laugh. If I did this, it made people laugh. If I lost in golf and went around and had to streak around the building, it made people laugh. And I'll tell you, I used to get emails from people or messages saying, Bromo, you're a funny guy. You know what? One time I was with my mother who was coming out of the hospital dealing with cancer, and she heard that thong bit you did, and she laughed and she smiled, and I hadn't seen her do that in months. I will admit that was a high. That was a high when I used to get stuff like that. But I'm telling you now, Kenny, nothing is better. Nothing's more satisfying than somebody reaching out and saying, hey, I just started listening to your podcast. I'm 6 months sober, and I'm absorbing everything that your guests are saying and that you're saying, and thank you. And I'll tell you what a thrill that is for me.
It is. It feels good, doesn't it?
It really does. It makes me feel like the guests that I have strategically are getting the point across to everyone out there. exactly what you said earlier. We all go through the fight. You've relapsed 18 times, which is quite a bit. I mean, that's quite a battle if you think about it. 18 times.
I call it field research.
Yeah, there you go.
I was convinced I could do it, and I proved to myself finally. When it came to the end, it was the end, and the, you know, you talk about in your story I was listening to with Keith, and the story you tell about Keith telling you that it appears the obsession, that you've lost the obsession to drink, is the moment that I got clean this time. By the way, I'm going to kind of interchange the words clean and sober.
Sure.
I'm mostly an NA kid. I grew up kind of in 12-step programs.
Yep.
Mostly NA. To me, they're interchangeable. Sue me. So, talking about that, the moment I got clean this time, August 21st, 2000, the obsession was gone the moment I walked back into a meeting.
Yeah.
And then I got home, and I got back home to the 12-pack of Heineken that I had bought that afternoon.
Right.
And I picked up the phone. I got a number that night from some burly biker, and I picked up the phone and I called him, and I was weeping and sniveling and crying. And he stayed on the phone with me while I cracked every single one of those and poured them down the drain. And it was, I'm going to tell you an amazing story. I've got a couple stories I do want to share, but this is the day I got clean. He's listening to me, and I'm just talking, and I'm sniveling, and I'm pouring, and I'm cracking, and everybody knows the sound of a bottle opening, you know.
Yep.
And I got done, and I was like thanking him, and I couldn't tell you his name. I couldn't tell you his name, but he helped save my life that night. And I was thanking him and all that stuff, and he goes, "You know what? Oh, that's great. Why don't you pour out that 12th one? He said, "Why don't you pour out that 12th one?
Pull out that last one and drink it, or pour it out to."
He was counting. He wasn't listening to me sniveling.
He was counting each. Yeah.
He was counting the. Listening to it glug 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 down the drain, and I was like, "Oh my god!" And I still, no matter what, I still had a. Big Book talks about it, that peculiar mental twist. It's my favorite three words in all of the AA Big Book, peculiar mental twist on page 33.
Yeah.
Is that no matter what, with all evidence to the contrary, I'm dying. I'm going to die. Maybe I can still have one, you know? And that person came on the phone with me and told me to pour it out, and I poured it out, and I will tell you that my life, from that day on, my sobriety date, my clean date, is one exploding point of light in my life, where everything good in my life today comes from that moment.
Well, ironically, that's probably what Andy was going through in his thoughts when you said maybe I can try, maybe I can have one, maybe I can ease into it again, and that's the biggest haunt of any alcoholic or addict, maybe.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in the book it says, you know, can we drink, or someone like, drink like a gentleman? And it's not possible. It is not possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I was convinced I could, you know, but yeah, no.
Yeah. So,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
I want to actually track back just a little bit to that day.
Yeah.
August 21st, 2000. Prior to that, I had been seeing a counselor through my insurance for probably a year at that point. I was not doing well. I was undiagnosed, pretty severe PTSD. I was self-medicating. I was going to a counselor and a shrink and getting sampling this antidepressant and that antidepressant, and they were working with me medically and trying all kinds of different angles. I wasn't sleeping. I was having horrible nightmares. My life was just in shambles. And what I had not been telling them when I kept going back and going, guess what? This drug's not working. It's not helping me.
Yeah.
This one's not working. I tried it for 6 weeks like you told me to. It's not helping. And this is such a significant part of the, literally the day I got clean. And I had already bought that 12-pack that morning, went to this psychiatrist appointment, went to see my counselor. And as I'm talking again, another person that same day went, hold on, and called me on my stuff, called me on it. And I've been talking about the antidepressants, and this counselor said, are you drinking? Are you drinking on top of those pills? And it was the first time I had told the truth in probably 5 or 6 years.
And why do you think that was? Why do you think? You were just ready? You're done?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's another one of those moments I try not to question too much.
Yeah.
I've shared this so many times in meetings, is I said yes. And I physically almost tried to grab the word out of the air and shove it back in my
mouth. Oh, yeah.
I could not believe I told the truth. Something inside of me was so finally desperate at that moment that I told the truth. Interestingly enough, jumping ahead quite a bit, I didn't end up seeing that counselor again. I ended up losing that insurance. I never saw that person again. But the day I had 10 years clean,
yep.
I called and left her a message and let her know. And she called me back. And we had a conversation that she was the catalyst. I know I did the work. I know I made the decision. I know I told the truth. But she was the one that called me on it. And I said yes. And I wanted her to know what an impact she made on my life. Because that day, I've been clean ever since.
That's terrific. I have to tell you something real quick, what you said earlier. I remember when I was attempting to be sober and attempting to fool everyone by telling everyone, oh, it's great. Yeah, I go to meetings and I really absorb them. And, I'll tell you what, it feels so good to be so. I'm lying the whole time.
Yeah.
And all those sentences, just like you said with that one word, all those sentences, I kept telling myself, quit talking too much because you know you're fooling yourself. Are you fooling everybody else?
We thought we were.
We thought we were, but that moment of clarity, the moment of when the obsession has been lifted is a special gift, I believe, from the heavens, from your higher power. It's a special gift, and it's something you'll never forget. And I'm glad you heard that episode with Keith. And when you said... what you just said these last couple minutes, it never leaves your brain, does it?
No. However, I'm going to say that with a caveat to that is we have incredible mechanisms as those with the disease of we have a great forgetter. Our picker is broken, and we have a great forgetter.
Yeah.
And I think it was another episode I listened to, Clayton. Wow, what a powerful guy. Also, I think I need a new sponsor. I think I need to talk to Clayton.
yeah.
That I can tend to forget. I can tend to forget that misery. I can tend to forget that pain. I can go on my daily life, my journey, and okay, what's this, what's that, and I forget that pain and that just absolute bottom of the barrel desperation. And one of the probably the most phenomenal things that my work gives back to me is I get to work with newcomers. I get to work with people in early recovery. I used to work in detox, so that was much, much heavier. 24-hour residential, all the stuff. Now working outpatient, our clients are a little bit further down the road, a little bit more independent, a little bit more able to kind of function in life as opposed to needing acute care, but still teaching those early recovery aspects, you know, the cliches, you know, all the stuff, and teaching those things. And now teaching those things in ASL. So I'm, as an added bonus, I get to teach those things in another language that I didn't know about 3 or 4 years ago.
Give us your sobriety date again.
August 21st, 2000.
So surely that you can't learn anything from newcomers, can you? I mean, come on, you've been sober that long.
Every day I learn.
See what I mean?
Every day I learn. Yeah. I've learned from your podcast. I mean, I didn't quite get through all 14 episodes of your story.
Yeah.
You kill me, man. Can I tell you something? Just what a significant part of listening to your story.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of just weird overlaps. You know, again, from San Diego, guy shows that Chargers 2000 season. I mean, come on, hold on. Do my clean date again, August 21st, 2000. Guess what happened in my first 3 or 4 months of sobriety? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I bled Bolt and I bleed Padres baseball, and that was brutal watching that. So I recall the billboard. I recall the building streaks. I recall all that stuff. At the time, I was working in a different field, doing a whole different job where I was working a lot of overnights and a lot of time alone and a lot of radio. And the Dave Show and Chainsaw Show, including Bromo, were a really big part of my early recovery. And it's been a real gift listening to your podcast, because I get these kind of your stories and I get to hear your inner monologue again and you talking, and it's been a nice blast from the past for me. And you've brought me back in many ways. Again, that's learning from you and learning your story. I had no idea. I had no, who would, because again, we were hiding it, and you were a personality on a radio show, and I was just a listener, and somebody that religiously listens every day, and it's almost devastating to hear now how much pain you were in during that time, and I know that you talked about it, how much you were able to live and felt like you were on top of the world, but I know that loneliness, I know that isolation, that devastation that you were talking about when you would be done with work and go back home and back to your room and the cooler in the trunk. I know those feelings, and I just want to tell you again, the work that you're doing this is giving back. You're spreading the word. You're going, hey, look, I can do it. Why can't you?
Well, remind me again the year exact year that I went up on that billboard, so I can tell people real quick, our audience out here in North Dakota, was it 2001, 2000?
I'm pretty sure it was the 2000 season. Chargers went like 1-15.
Yeah, so we're out golfing, and my best friend Dave, and he says, hey, guess what you're going to do on Friday? Because at this point, the Chargers were 0-10. I said, what are we doing on this Friday? And he goes, you're going up on a billboard, and you're not coming down to the Chargers win. And I said, say that again. And so he said that again. And so a day later or so, there I am with a little bag of stuff. And I get on this crane, scissor lift crane, which is right next to the Bromo billboard, which says Bromo billboard. And they lift me up 51 feet up in the air. And I got a little bit of space up there. I got a little outdoor shack that you can, in San Diego, cold as if it gets below like 45. I get a shack like you put your lawnmowers in where I can close the doors. They got a webcam up there, and they got eventually a Lazy Boy chair was brought up there. I could lower the crane to let press and media on there, but I could not get off the crane. I would lower the crane down. I would raise the crane up. I had a red bucket, with a rope attached to it that I'd throw over the side where people can come by and wave and yell and deliver stuff like... 12-pack of beer. Well, a Playgirl magazine. I thank you that. I don't think I'll use that. All kinds of weird stuff. And it made national news. And they had they would call me in the morning and wake me up. The police would come by. Hey, Bromo, you doing okay up there? And they would shine this shiny light up on me. And I always thanked them so much. But I was hungover like you wouldn't believe because... You know, I had it all up there. If I had my booze, this and this and this, people would bring me stuff to eat. But I reveled in the whole limelight deal, you know? But when the things got bad, and I'm glad you brought this up, when things got bad on the show and I knew that my drinking wasn't just a time for me to relax and settle down. It wasn't. It strangleholded me, and I couldn't relay that on the air until one day I disappeared. And then I was gone for a little bit, and I went to outpatient. And I won't give you my opinion on outpatients if you are a legitimate hardcore alcoholic like I am, because if they allow you to go home, boom, it's on. And if they only let you go Monday, Wednesday, Friday to outpatient class, you know you can drink on a Tuesday and you got to stop at a certain point because they might pee test you. So I went to two different tries at outpatient, bombed on both of them, went to McDonald's Center, the 28-day spend dry, got out of there with a note to go back to work cleared by my counselors. For a week, hey, you're ready to go back to work in a week. And then that Monday, Obama was sworn in as our new president. And I got a phone call from Clear Channel telling me that I was laid off along with like 2,000 other people around the country. I remember as the clock is ticking and I've got all this idle time, and I looked at my cardboard box table. I'm not kidding. I had a cardboard box as a table next to my bed with a energy drink that I couldn't stand, with a horrible croissant that I took three bites into. And all I wanted was to try again, one more try. Hey, man, I made it a month. I made it 5 weeks. This has got to be it this time. But the back of my mind was saying, no, it ain't, brother. Valentine's Day. You know, I'm hearing people walking around. I'm looking out the alleyway in Mission Beach, the Disneyland of drunks, and I'm watching people carrying their booze and their women and, you know, their dates and their booze and, having a great old time, and there's my energy drink, and I gave it one more shot, and I realized to myself the second that I took that first sip as I'm sitting on my bed, I started crying. And you know why I started crying, don't you, Kenny?
I do.
You know why? Because you know it was all over. You know that there's no way I could ease back in to a sober life with a drink now and then. Ain't going to happen.
Yeah. I don't remember which one of your episodes talked about it, but somebody else mentioned, I think it was actually Ruthie, who's a wonderful, wonderful human being, and the talk about addiction being a relationship. And it is. And when we finally come to that point, I can stop. I can stop obsessing about this thing. I can let it go. I have to let it go. And because it becomes our primary relationship in our lives, everything else is tertiary. Everything else is on the outskirts. Is, okay, my friends, my family, my job, paying bills, all of it is technically secondary to this relationship. I need to maintain this relationship at all costs, and I need to protect it.
Yeah.
And then when that relationship turns on us and is no longer working and is no longer the coping skill we need it to be, and it has become the problem, that's when the breakup occurs, and that's when we have to go through that devastating loss.
Yeah.
And you're right. Outpatient is not for everyone. It is a level of care. I would go ADC is probably about a C level of care as far as where it ranks in the need. You've got acute care in detox,
yeah,
which often includes medication intervention. You've got residential care after that, which you're familiar with, and then a step down to outpatient care, which is it's part of a discharge plan. It's not, okay, you've done 28 days, now you're ready to go to outpatient and come in whenever you want. You gotta be ready for something like that. So
yeah.
It's not something I would ever recommend for somebody that's just getting sober.
No, and I want to touch back on what you're talking about newcomers as to what you do for a living. And you're around a lot of newcomers, and they are raw, and they are down, and they are... You know, most of them are not ready to surrender, or some of them are, but they don't know how to go about it. They don't have the tools. And this is where this is what I was saying earlier. If I had a job like yours, what an amazing thing to wake up to every single day when you go to work. And when you go to a newcomer, or I guess you go to more than one in a class or one in a group, your thought process is, do you spin right away to what it was like when you were a newcomer? You know, and you, I know that right away. You don't want to hit anybody too hard, but I know you've got the tools set up for people to introduce them to them. Can you explain a little bit about your mind thought and your process without giving away too much about your job, about how you approach newcomers or people that have failed many times and are back and say, hey, I give up.
Yeah. Everything's case by case, man. We're all individuals, and addiction, pretty much all of us are polysubstance users. You rarely find somebody, especially these days, that used only this or only that. We supplement. So it really depends on the person, and it's just getting a read on somebody and getting an understanding of where they're at. You've got so many different levels of when you're first coming in contact with somebody. You've got the chronic retreads like me, the ones that have been in and out for years that know the 12 steps and the principles and the traditions on the back of their hands and can quote them and can't apply them. And then you've got the hardcore agnostics that want nothing to do with it's about God, and everywhere in between. And I do want to make that statement too. Treatment, clinical treatment, actual working with substance use disorder, treatment is not 12-step. 12-step is its own entity, self-help fellowships, and it's such an important tool. But when we use that as a guide, as a model in treatment, it's as an example. It's, you know, oftentimes it's how I got my recovery. But I work with people that are not 12-steppers. Some are in smart recovery. Some just go to therapy. There's so many different layers and understanding, kind of like a higher power. There's no right answer. There's no one method. And as soon as I fall into that, well, this is what I do. A newcomer shows up, and I run them through A, B, and C. I'm going to kill people if I do that.
Yeah,
people are going to die because I need to know. I've got a particular joy in my life right now is and again, trying to be, following immunity. We've been able over the last couple of years to pull multiple people out of custody, out of jail, and out of prison, and get them into treatment, and they are doing well, and they are putting together years of recovery, and they are graduating programs, and they are starting to put lives together. And so much of that is God, I can't, So how do I approach somebody that's been in prison for 10 years as opposed to the young guy off the street?
Yeah.
Or the woman who's been battered and has 3 kids and has been left alone. All these different layers in our world that we reach. And you never know the next contact you're going to get. You never know the next email, the next call, the next person that shows up and says, I need help. And that's, I think, part of what keeps people going. You've talked about it being such a gift and such a joy, and sure, it is, and it's phenomenal. It's also very, very crushing.
It's got to be.
The pain.
It's got
to
be.
I've been to too many funerals. I've talked to too many parents who've lost their kids.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it that way. Yeah, I couldn't do what you do that way. Yep.
Yeah. No. So it is. I think what does keep me, keeping it on a me, I statement, what keeps me going is that I need to pick myself up. I need to put on my big boy pants. I need to be there tomorrow for that person that's going to call me or contact me by email or send me a text or whatever it is that says I need help or my son needs help or my daughter's missing, all of these things. And those are the things that kind of keep us going. And we can set aside our petty things, our drama, and go, okay, how can I help you? What can I do here?
Yeah.
You know, and we're not always successful. We're not. Not at all. And if we think we're going to be, we're fooling ourselves. This is a disease that kills.
You brought back a whirlwind of memories when you said people in prison. I remember my first day or so at Freedom Ranch, way out in Campo. You ever been out there?
I have.
It's the most glorious place in the world. I would give anything to be able to go there every single night. I really, and ironically, I used to say, I hate this place. Once I leave here, I'm never coming back. But I remember sitting in that front row and during class and seeing this marked van or unmarked van come rolling in, and these guys jumping out in orange jumpsuits. They take them over to the shed where people donated clothes. And they took them over there, and they got all clothed up in normal clothes, and they came over, and they came marching in. And I guess they had a choice of either going to Freedom Ranch or, you know, doing some time. And I'm guessing that most people say, well, what is this ranch all about? Tell me more about it. You know, it's a lot more freedom than behind bars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned the pain. This is something that I would have a problem with, because I take things, you know, I'm a lot like people, sounds like you. I'm a lot like where I wear my feelings on my shoulders, and when you do the job that you do, the pain is part of it. And when you've lost so many people, now turn that around. What's it like when someone comes walking through your door and says, hey, man, hey, Kenny, I just reached my five-year anniversary, my five-year sobriety date. And thank you to you on that. What's that like? It's got to be nothing better.
I can't describe it. I can't. Brief story is I've got a friend.
Yeah.
I met him when I worked at the detox. He was a business development individual for a different treatment center, and we had a business relationship. He and I became friends. Several years in, their adolescent child needed help, and we facilitated that and made sure that they got the help that they needed, and it came through our treatment center, everything else. I got to see him, my friend, about 2 months ago, and it was a big meeting. There's all these PhDs and all the stuff around, and there's 70 people and all the big waves and la 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 la, and I'm just me with a blue mohawk and tattoos everywhere.
Yeah.
And he points out, because he told the story about his kid, and he told the story about how his kid has 6 years clean now, and he pointed at me and he said, that man right there helped save my son's life. And I was like, dude, I can't, you know. And I'm an incredibly emotional person. What makes me a terrible addict, and B, what makes me a good counselor, is I can reach that empathy. I can reach that level of understanding, and it made me cry. It does, you know. It's my buddy Andy. I want to talk about him. He has come to quite a few things over the years at my house. Love to play poker. I've had plenty of little sobriety celebrations, XYZ. He's been to many of them. He's come to my house and played poker. He's always been very respectful, but he would like, you know, bring a six-pack of beer. Kenny, is it okay if I bring beer? Yeah, it's fine, man. It's fine.
He told me about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's fine. He was always respectful about it and stuff. But it's funny, because everybody in my world, everybody, especially around the poker table, everybody's in recovery, you know? And it was fine. We love you. You're good. You're a good man.
Yeah.
It's fine. So when he, a couple of years ago, reached out to me and told me, I have a problem, I was like, no. And that he was going to treatment, and I couldn't. I don't know, that same feeling of, oh, thank God, you know, and I never, ever, ever imagined. And our relationship is one that once he was sober, he was going to meetings, he had come out of his treatment program, and he had called me and asked me if I would sponsor him.
Mm-hmm.
I said briefly, I love you, and I will briefly sponsor you, but that is not fair to you in any way, because there's no possible way you'll be completely honest with me.
Yeah.
We've had way too long a relationship. You need someone neutral.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody that doesn't know you. We're talking stories. I moved to Ramona from El Cajon to get away from drugs. All I did was create a trafficking route for meth.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I'll bet.
I was like, oh, you guys have crap up here. We're going to go to El Cajon.
Yeah.
This is the level of relationship and how long Andy and I have known each other. I cut the squares of carpet out of his parents' living room because we dropped dope on it.
Yeah.
And I shook that crap out on mirrors and would do it and do it along with him. And that's the level of just degradation that we went to. And for something like that, to be fair to him, to be the most useful to him, I had to say no. And I had to say, okay, I can sponsor you for a little bit, and I need you to call me, and we're going to talk about this, but you're going to find a new sponsor very, very quickly because I'm not it.
Yeah.
So I have stayed completely out of his recovery journey and his recovery path. And I'm now realizing maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe I didn't see the signs. And because, A, we're so adept at cleaning up our path and hiding. But B, I'm naive still. I believe the best in people. I think, oh, that's my buddy Andy. He's sober, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know that he was struggling. And you and I had actually talked about this. Andy and I had gone to a concert recently. It was just he and I, and we hung out all night. And I realized, looking back, oh, you'd been drinking up to that point. That must have been incredibly hard for you.
Oh, it has to be.
A club, you know?
Yeah. Remember now, Kenny, remember, we're brilliant actors.
Oh,
we're brilliant liars, and we can lie our ways through anything. But
we're the screenwriter, the director, the actor, the set builder. Yeah.
But there's a million, not a million. There are ways to find out. And I had thought about this when you were talking just a second ago.
Yeah.
I'm no expert. No, I'm over 16 years sober, and your sobriety date again is?
August 21st, 2000.
2000. You got 25 years you're coming up on.
24. 2000. Let me earn the rest of it.
Oh, of course. Well, no, you said your date is August what?
August
21st. 2000, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so this August, this August it'll be 25.
August will be 25, God willing, yes.
So sometimes people will say, and they'll know, and they've heard us, and I'm quite proud of it, and I don't go around, and that's not the first thing that I say to people, but they might see my tattoo or whatever, or what I'm wearing, my jewelry, and I'll say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, and don't even bat an eye. And sometimes people will back up a little bit and go, well, listen, then they got questions for you. And then it's like, I'm not an expert, dude, but you can go probably online, at least online, and look at the warning signs, if you know anybody. Look at the warning signs that'll say, do you drink alone, which is I used to do all the time. Do you think about drinking all day long? Do you miss work? Is it affecting relationships? All of that and more. You've had that happen to you, too, I'm sure, where there were people. And what I love about what you just said about Andy is you're not a judge. You know what it is, but you can also tell, kind of. But then again, you can't, because he was a great actor.
Yeah. What did you tell people when they caught you? Hey, are you drinking? No! Right?
Well, Ruthie caught me right away one time. I went in there, and she said, dude, your body reeks of alcohol, vodka. So I used to take antiperspirant when I was sober and rub it all over my body until I started smelling the vodka on my sheets.
Uh-huh.
In my breath, everywhere I went, it was a battle. And I'm telling you, that battle in the hell of hiding everything from people is not fun. And this is when you know you're going downhill, downhill pretty quick. Momentum is starting to roll downhill, and it's not fun.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? And in the years that you've been doing this, and I was lucky enough and grateful enough to go to two wonderful places. And I won't say Scripps McDonald Center wasn't a great place, but it's just not long enough. It's not. But I was so fortunate to go to Freedom Ranch for 120 days. I got that call, and I went to Pathfinders for 9 months. How has things changed between nowadays and back then? Because back then, there were all kinds of ways where you can get disability, you can get this, you can get that, you can get this and that and that. But I've been told a couple of times from a friend of mine that used to work at Freedom Ranch that things are a little bit more regimental as far as medical and this and that and this. Or have things changed quite a bit in programs of recovery?
Yes. Let's just say that. Yes. As always, I have kind of a unique path.
Yeah.
I came from the private industry.
Yeah.
And that was the detox. I worked at 7 years.
Okay.
I was the director of it for 5. And then COVID. And COVID just kind of changed all of our worlds. And then now I work in the public sector. It's our program is funded by county funds. So we have a county contract. So we don't bill insurance. We bill Medi-Cal.
Okay.
So yeah, the private industry, the private insurance industry. I'll say this too: the recovery field as a business is as better now. It was as sick as they come. It was running kind of hand in hand with the opiate epidemic. People used to refer to things like the Florida model. I have a brief story. I had a parent call me when I worked at a detox, and it was probably one of the most impactful treatment phone calls I've ever received because it hurt so bad. Is this parent called me, and they were looking for a place for their young child. They were late teens, early 20s. And they're telling me the story that they had been in and out of this treatment center, that treatment center. They've been going through the system for 6 years. And this parent asked me, Kenny, just tell me, what insurance plan do I need to buy so that I can get my kid to your center? That hurts so much.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't believe
wow.
how wrong and how badly we were doing it. You know, how badly the field out there is just robbing people, not of money, but their lives.
Yeah.
And to hear that, it was, and I had to ask, what are you talking about? And they had been taught by the drug and alcohol treatment industry, by the field, by quote unquote professionals, that they could buy this insurance plan and it would cover it here. But as soon as that money ran out and as soon as that coverage ran out, they had to be discharged. And I don't know where your kid's going to go, but they can't be here. So they would convince them to buy new insurance plans and they would turn a little around.
Oh, yeah.
Awful, you know? Yeah. And luckily there was a lot of people caught, a lot of fraud and a lot of abuse. And from my perspective, at least, a lot of that has been cleaned up. I'm kind of grateful I'm out of the private industry and in public area. However, it's still such a giant loophole. It is such a pain. And getting Medi-Cal coverage and getting people qualified to be given treatment. I love what I do because we charge our clients absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Nothing.
That's
they never
amazing.
Pay a dime for treatment. And we've had clients with us for 2 years.
That's amazing.
And that ability is what, again, kind of keeps me going. I'm a terrible businessman. I will tell you that. I will give away treatment for free all day long. And it's, you know, so I will never, ever forget that phone call. And I think that's probably one of the things that bolstered me so much over the years. Is to keep righting that wrong, keep on treating, and keep on doing.
Yeah.
I haven't done this my whole life. I came to this accidentally. I was 9 years clean, and I got severely hurt on the job, and I could no longer do my job anymore. So I guess I'll go check out working in treatment. You know, here I am.
Yeah. Hey, I got to tell you something, and I've not told a whole lot of people this, so I'm kind of...
You tell everybody now.
I figure I'm an open book. I'll tell you how stupid I am. So I get to Freedom Ranch, and I get rolling. And, you know, the whole protocol, and then this, and then this is how we do things, this is how we do things.
Yeah.
And this guy rolls over to me, and he goes, hey, and a lot of people knew who I was, and that's okay. They knew that I was Bromo and whatever. But one of the guys that knew who I was, he comes over, and he goes, hey, man, you know, you can qualify for disability, right? And I go, I didn't know that. He goes, yeah, well, we're taking down five or six people. Tomorrow we're going down the hill, is how they put it. We're going down the hill to Pathfinders and, no, we're going down the hill to a doctor, to a regular doctor, who was assigned to, you know, go over you and then clear you and then you qualify for disability. Well, so everything was clear and I started getting disability. However, I completely forgot. I don't know how stupid I was. Maybe because I was living in a fog and I didn't want to be there and I thought, where's my world going? I had no clue what I was going to do afterwards. But while I was collecting disability, I was still getting my 9-month severance plan from Clear Channel.
Yeah.
So yeah, disability runs out after a year. Yeah, I do that for Freedom Ranch and then I roll over to Pathfinders and then all suddenly disability stops after a year. That's how it was back then. And and I started to panic a little bit. And then when I got out of Pathfinders and graduated, I had about 3 or 4 guys all set up, sober guys. We had a house. We were all going to share the rent. And I went to make a phone call because people said, hey, now you can get unemployment. And the guy goes to me, goes, you ain't getting a dime. As a matter of fact, you're going to wind up owing us money. And I'm like, well, how do you figure? Well, that's what happens.
The wreckage of our present, huh?
Yeah, I got
we make some dumb choices.
Well, you know what? I just have to tell you, it's been an honor having you on, Kenny, and I want you to think about a couple of words here. I want you to talk to my audience real quick, because my audience, and I'm grateful for it, takes these podcasts exactly how I want them to be. They let their friends hear it. They let people, relatives, or they listen to it when they're new on the path. I want you to take a couple of minutes and tell people the glorious road of sobriety, will you, if you can?
Wow.
That's a pretty heavy thing to lay on you, I know. But
yeah, you come at it, man. You launch that. It's so personal. So personal. There are days that I still look at my life and I am convinced I don't deserve it. The reality is, once the pain got great enough, once it was the end of my road, once I was able to finally see, I could stop lying, I could stop hiding it, I could stop all of the drama and go, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. Everything in my life right now, from my dog to my, I've been married for 21 years.
Awesome.
I have a beautiful son who's 19. When I met my wife, she had a 4-year-old daughter. So I've raised a stepdaughter. She's now 27 years old. I've been able to put these things together. I was a street junkie, man. I wasn't fancy. I wasn't a dealer. I was scraping resin out of pipes to keep getting high.
Yeah.
I was stealing power tools when I was 14 to trade for dope. That's the person that I was.
Yeah.
And the reality is, for me, part of my story is I've never been arrested. Briefly arrested, but I've never been handcuffed. I've never been in custody. I've never been any of those things. However, my life has taken me to points where I almost committed first-degree murder.
Yeah.
And I would still be, I will tell you this, I was on active duty at the time, so I would still be in Leavenworth Prison. And the reality is I can look around, I can have conversations with people like you, I can look at my friend Andy, who's trying desperately to get sober again and put his life back together.
Yeah.
I can look at my beautiful wife and my beautiful kids who have never, ever, ever seen me loaded. I met my wife. I had 20 months clean.
Wait, say that again. Say that last part again. Your wife. Say
my
that
wife.
Last. That must be
my
an
wife,
amazing thing. Your wife and your son has never seen you loaded.
My wife and my kids have never seen me loaded.
What a great gift.
And I expect, I'll tell you this, I expect if I do, they'll be gone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's how I use them. B, I would deserve that.
What a great gift.
Because that's not who they know. That's not who they who they've built a relationship with. And when I get clean, when I got sober, the person that I was, eventually, it took a long time. I'm in no way saying for a second I did it right. It took me 3.5 years this time to do my first 4-step. And I finally, again, even sober, had to get to a point where I was in so much misery that I finally had to do what was suggested to me for a decade.
Pretty scary to think about what we used to be like, isn't it?
Sometimes it's scary to think what I used to be like last week, man.
Yeah.
So when you ask, can you learn from others? Yeah, I learn every single day.
Yeah.
And when I become teachable, when I remain teachable, I can grow. And I can grow and I can build on this and I can be there for my buddy when he gets out of treatment. And I can go, you know what? I feel like I did it wrong. I will tell you this, Andy. Maybe a year or two ago, I sat down with him at a taco shop, you know, San Diego, so we got to have taco shops. And I said, you know what, dude, I got to make an amends to you. You were talking about amends in your podcast that you made to Dave. I sat down with Andy, and for the first time in my life, for the first time in our 34 years, I got to make an amends to him, and I needed to. And he was like, I said, no, I need to.
Yeah.
I need to. And I hurt you, and I did you wrong. And I had no idea how to even be a human being at that point. I realized we were kids, but I did you wrong. And that has tortured me for the last 34 years. And I need to tell you, and I appreciate you just listening for a second. And he didn't leave.
Wow. Hey, one last thing before.
And you still love me.
One last thing before I let you go, Kenny. And you'll definitely agree with me on this. To you newcomers out there, never ever feel like when you're going up to somebody who's been around for a while, like Kenny, or even someone that's been 3 years sober, 2 years sober, never, never feel ashamed or if you have anything you want to talk to somebody about, always reach out to anybody who's got a little bit of sobriety, whether maybe it's maybe it's just 9 days. I mean, we're all going through it. And when you get someone like Kenny that you've just heard this amazing story on what he does for people in San Diego and how he takes what you said earlier, and if it's okay with you, I want to use this with a title. And you can tell me yes or no right now on the air, but I love what you said. I will give away treatment all day long. And that hits it right there on the head. That says that what he's doing is from his heart, from his soul, from giving back. You'll hear giving back a lot, giving back and knowing what it's like to face this battle every single day. You okay with that if I use that for the title?
Sure, man. Sure, I'm on it.
But I don't want people to go, hey, Kenny, by the way, I just got your title. I heard the podcast. I want to bring in...
You're giving it away, aren't you?
So yeah. If we get off the air and he tells me not to use this title, you'll see another title.
No,
like Bromo's lame or something like that. But
fine, brother.
You know, my heroes have changed in life. A long time ago, of course, they were sports heroes.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working in radio in San Diego doing what I absolutely loved, my hero, we all know, was the leader of that show, Dave. And by the way, I wish I could talk more about Dave, but Dave is still my hero. So my heroes are also people like Keith,
mm-hmm.
are also George, who used to be at Freedom Ranch, George Martinez, who passed away, I believe now it's been a couple of years ago. I walked mm-hmm. into Freedom Ranch on the dusty, dirty, hot grounds mm-hmm. of Campo, scared out of my mind. And George Martinez, who was running the ranch out there, he comes walking out of the kitchen. I'll never forget it. And he comes over and he sees me, and I told my stepbrother, I don't belong out here. I don't belong out here. And he goes, yeah, you do. And so he sits down with me and he goes, all right, first of all, I know who you are. I know who you are and who you worked for. I'm a listener. I know you're Bromo, and here you're Dave. You're absolutely Dave. I'm going to get you your confidence back. I'm going to get you on your feet. I'm going to make you feel better. I'm going to make you see the glorious ways of working the program and staying sober and being around others. Because, you know, I came from a Mission Beach area where I was swinging, going to the bar across the street. I had two cats, living it up like a Hollywood star. You know, and George Martinez comes along and rebuilds my confidence. That's one of my heroes. You are also one of my heroes, Kenny, for what you do. And you're humble, but you know that you provide a service where you save lives. You save lives, and you've saved many lives before in the past.
I appreciate that, man.
Of course.
It's one thing I do tell people that I work with and remind people of every day is we are in the trenches as a leader in the field, as somebody who's running the program. I don't believe in leading from up on high. I need to get down in the trenches. I need to tell that story of the addict that jumps down in the hole with the person that needs help and shows them how to get out. And it's what we do every single day. You know, I think I was meant to do this, and the way that I came into it, we didn't touch on that, fine. But I believe I was kind of directed into this probably by my higher power. It's like, you're wasting your time doing that. You need to be doing this. And now I get a fulfillment. I'm not gonna lie to you for a second. Working in treatment, everybody's broke. There's no money in it. There's no money in the field.
No, I know.
And it's hard. It's hard. But I get so much.
Way more. Way more than most people do who have a... And their jobs are cool, but way more. Okay, I have a new title. You tell me what you like better. I will give away treatment all day long, or I need to get down in the trenches.
I like that.
Okay, I like that one too, that second one. Kenny, you're an awesome man. You've been a wonderful guest. You hang on with me real quick, okay?
Thank you, man.
Hang on. I've said this 1,000 times, and I'll say it 1,000 times over. My strength of my podcast, There Is a Way Out, are my guests like Kenny. Imagine having your life saved. Imagine having someone like Kenny come into your world with There Is a Way Out. And that's what he does. My name is Brummel. Thanks for being part of There Is a Way Out.